From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Hello, world. That's how Tiger Woods greeted the media on the eve of his professional debut. He was too young to drink legally, but had already made $60 million. Then he went on to become the greatest golfer in modern history. A blazing talent, a meteoric rise to fame, whose star burned out amid a marital infidelity scandal. Now, Tiger Woods is back on the golf course, looking for another chance at greatness. Others are looking back at how he got here. This hour on Point, the story of Tiger Woods. You can join us on air or online. Are you a Tiger Woods fan? Did he get you to watch golf? Are you rooting for a Tiger comeback? Or did his fall from grace sour your view of him for good? And joining me now from New York are Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan, co-authors of Tiger Woods, which is out today. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. In addition to writing this book, Jeff is special features writer for Sports Illustrated and an author of 15 other books. And Jeff Benedict, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hello, Anthony.
And Armin Katayan is a CBS News and 60 Minutes correspondent and author of 10 books. Armin Katayan, great to have you as well. Armin, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Good to have you. So, gentlemen, remind us, I think a good place to start, particularly for the non-golf fans in our audience, just how spectacular an athlete Tiger Woods was when he was at his best. There's a lot of ways to measure that greatness, but sum it up for us. You call him modern history's greatest athlete. How so? Who wants to take that on?
I'll take it. It's Armin. I think, you know, one of the great things about this book is it reminded us in many ways just how great Tiger was, what a difference he was as far as an athlete was concerned. And, you know, you have to start with the numbers. 79 PGA Tour wins, second all time to Sam Snead, 14 majors, second only to the great Jack Nicklaus, player of the year, 11 times, scoring leader 9 times, more than $110 million earned on tour events worldwide, just totally dominated the tour basically from 1999 through 2009 in ways that the tour had never seen before. He was a transcendent talent. We liken him to Shakespeare, someone that you see once and may never see again.
And what did he do for professional golf? I mean, you point out that at the height of his career in golf, he beat the NFL and NBA in ratings, right?
Well, he changed the face of golf racially, socially, culturally, and financially. He made multi-million-dollar athletes out of 400 tour pros. He took the PGA Tour purses from an average of $1.7 million in 1996 to $7.1 million during this season, from $63 million in total purses in 1996 when he became a pro, to $363 million as we now look at this season. I mean, he was a meteor that ran across the sky that we all watched and we were all thrilled by, but what was going on in Tiger's own personal world was very, very different.
Right, and we're going to talk a lot about this, but let me come back. I'll ask you to take this question, Jeff. I mean, just sort of one more question about sort of his greatness as a golf player. What was it that made him so great? I mean, at the physical level, what did he do with a golf club? I mean, what was the superhuman power that he had?
Well, I was smiling at Armin when you asked your first question about why were so many non-golfers attracted to him, and Armin's laughing now because I've never played golf in my life. And Armin's been golfing for a long time and loves the sport. I had very little familiarity with the sport when he and I started working on this book. And yet, a guy like me who doesn't care about golf or play golf can be, frankly, just entranced by things that Tiger does on a golf course that look fake. A perfect example of that is we have two scenes in this book where he hits shots that seem humanly impossible because one of them is literally in the dark. He can't see the hole, which is a long ways away from where he's hitting, and yet he drops his ball within inches of the hole. And there's this incredible scene where there's all these people around the hole holding up cell phones and lighters, sort of illuminating the hole as his ball lands. There's no one else who can do things like that. And I think the reason that he is like that is because from the beginning, when he was still sitting in a high chair in a garage off the side of his house watching his dad hit and hit and hit while his mother put spoons of food in his mouth in between hits, he was exposed to pretty much nothing but golf. He was putting in incredible hours as a toddler, practicing and learning how to play. And by the time he got to kindergarten, this was a kid who had a skill set that was – you wouldn't see someone that age who could hit a ball 50 yards straight. And he could do that well past that by that time in his life. And I think that's why by the time he comes on the national scene as a pro, he was doing things as a 19 and 20-year-old that no one had ever seen done before.
Anthony, could I just interject something,
too? Please, Armin, go ahead.
Yeah. Physically, he changed the game. You saw him in his very tightly cut shirts. He was a he could have looked like an NFL safety at certain parts of his life. Not only physically, he hit the ball longer. He's a savant. There's one story we tell very quickly where he's testing six prototypical drivers for Nike, and the Nike people say they all weigh the same. Just you know, take them and test them. He goes, "No, I like the heavy one," and they're like, "No, you don't understand. They all weigh the same." So he said, "No, this one's heavier." And so they sent him back to the testing lab in Fort Worth. And sure enough, they took the drivers apart. Five of them weighed the exact same. One of them, they had put some drops of kind of goo to keep the titanium together in the head of the driver. It was the difference of the weight of two $1 bills. It was 2 grams different. And Tiger could tell the difference from the feel of the club in his hand. So not only was he physically different, and mentally he had a warrior mentality, a cold assassin kill him mentality, but he did have these savant-like skills that are just, you know, they're otherworldly in so many ways.
We're talking to Armin Katayan and Jeff Benedict about co-authors of a new biography called Tiger Woods. And let's start listening to a little bit of the voices from this story. So Tiger Woods made his first national television appearance at the age of 5 with his father, Earl Woods, on the ABC show That's Incredible. So here's Earl Woods talking about his son, Tiger.
Parents should be supportive. We can't dictate to him what he can be and what he cannot be. So as a consequence, what we do is we participate with him in golf. And if it was bowling, we would participate with him in bowling. And each and every one of us has our own life to live. And he has a choice to live his life the way he wants to live his life.
And apparently that choice was to play golf. So here's Tiger Woods, 5 years old, on that same program, That's Incredible, sharing a golfing goal he had when he was older.
When I'm going to be 20, I'm going to beat Jed Nicklaus and Tom Watson.
So when I'm going to be 20, I'm going to beat Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson. Woods has won 79 official PGA Tour events, second only to Sam Snead. He's won 14 majors, second all time behind Jack Nicklaus. So, gentlemen, Armin and Jeff, I want to talk about his dad because in much of the book we see the role of his dad. You start the book with the role of his dad. So tell us a little bit about Earl Woods, who, among other things, made these amazing claims that you remind us about his son. He predicted in Sports Illustrated that his then 2-year-old son would have more influence on the world than Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, or Buddha.
Yeah, and it's interesting that clip you played, Anthony. Earl is saying that a 5-year-old can decide. And anybody who's been a parent knows that 5-year-olds don't decide. Parents decide when you're 5. Parents make the decisions for 5-year-olds. And I think a lot of decisions were made for Tiger when he was 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up through high school and even through college. His parents had an overwhelming presence in his life. And one of the, you know, positive things that came out of that was some of the things that Armin was just mentioning in terms of his excellence as a golfer. But there were some costs to that. And Earl had the kind of personality where he put, you know, we made a claim in the book that it's sort of like the Great Expectations of Pip that were put on Tiger here. They were huge, and they were constantly piled on him, largely by his father. His dad made a decision when Tiger was 2 years old to make a telephone call to the top sports television broadcaster in the Los Angeles market, and he convinced this guy to come down and watch his 2-year-old hit golf balls. And the guy was very skeptical, but he came down and he watched him. And when he saw how this 2-year-old could play, he put him on television in Los Angeles. And that led to him being on national television a couple of months later. Earl did things that it's hard to know for certain what his motives were that early whether he was just a parent that was super proud of his son or whether it was more calculating. But what we do know is that he put his son on a course as a two-year-old that was going to dramatically change his life and turn him into what he became.
Yeah. I don't think you can forget, Anthony, either, that Catilda, Tita, his mom, is the other side of this equation. And when you look at Tiger's real first name, Eldrick, the E literally stands for Earl and the K stands for Catilda. So he, Tiger, is literally surrounded by his parents, both figuratively and literally, from the time he was born. And some would say, as you read the book and you understand the profound influence of Tita and Earl on Tiger, that he was imprisoned by his parents. There are many positive things that came out of the love relationship that this family had. But the family dynamic, there's another side, a darker side to this. And as Tiger grows older and the book progresses, that dark side becomes clearer and clearer.
Yeah, I mean, among the things, so he was an only child early on, not a particularly social child. You describe a guy, a young man who stayed in his room, and this intense privacy really defined him and his family for a long, long time. Right, Jeff? Or Armin, sorry, I can't see you guys, so you're just going to have to answer.
No, yeah, I just pointed at Jeff because it's in his wheelhouse right here.
I don't know why I sense that.
The privacy thing is something that Armin and I, we struggled with to get our hands around it. But this kid was raised in a house where it was three people and everybody else was basically walled out. And that was, by the time he got to college, that's all he knew.
Wow. Well, we're going to get back and talk a lot more about that, about the world that Tiger Woods grew up in. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about a new biography of golfing great Tiger Woods. You can join the conversation. What about Tiger Woods as a role model for people in the black community? What do you make of the fact that at times he distanced himself from being black? So on the eve of making his professional debut, Tiger Woods announced answered questions at the 1996 Milwaukee Open. The press conference became known as his Hello World appearance because that's how the young star greeted the media. It was a nod to a line in a Nike commercial that had yet to air. And after confidently saying he had no concerns about going pro, Woods took questions from a reporter.
Tiger, not many people begin with a news conference like this. You've already gotten a feel just from this pro-am on what the attention's going to be like. How are you going to keep your head on? That's what a lot of people say, that you'll go as far as you can keep your head in the game. How are you going to do that?
How am I going to do that? I'm going to play one shot at a time, and I have one hell of a good time.
One shot at a time and have one hell of a good time. My guests today are Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan, co-authors of Tiger Woods, which is just out today. You can find an excerpt at our website at On Point Radio. Jeff, Armin, we've got a bunch of callers already on the line who want to get into this conversation. They can do that by calling 1-800-423-8255. So let's take a couple. Rodney is calling from Buffalo, New York. Rodney, you're on the air. Go ahead. It's good to have you.
Hello, Anthony. It's nice that I get to be on the air. So Tiger Woods, big fan. I'm looking forward to his comeback. I really think he has it in him still. His mistake he made, you know, that whole marriage thing. He's human. He's not perfect. And there's a lot of other really good athletes that made the same mistake. But, you know, when the light's on you, people expect you to be perfect, which none of us are. So I really don't hold that against him.
All right. So there's Rodney. So Rodney, you're rooting for a Tiger comeback. Jeff and Armin, you start your book with a chapter called The End, November 27th, 2009, barefoot and groggy, the most powerful athlete on the planet, hid behind a locked bathroom door for years. Like an escape artist, he had been able to cover the tracks of his secret life, not this time. Remind us what happened that day.
Well, that is that scene is set literally moments before he's going to run out of his house in his socks in the middle of the night and get in an SUV and start careening and plowing into things and then come to a stop in his neighbor's yard and end up laying on the side of the road and having a 911 call. And Armin and I struggled a lot trying to figure out where to start the life, this guy's life. And the reason we called that chapter The End and we opened in that moment is because we couldn't think of a more dramatic image than the most powerful athlete in the world behind a locked door. And then obviously we run from there. But I think the caller that just called in and expressed those feelings that he has, I think there's a lot of people who feel like that in the United States. And to cover this man's life as we have for the last 3 years, we gained quite an appreciation for the spotlight he talked about, I think, was brighter on this athlete than any athlete who's ever come along.
Yeah.
And it burns hot. And I think he's been under a microscope that, in fairness, his father built the microscope and turned the lights on. And then it just got bigger and brighter as he got better and better.
And I think you have to look at it, Anthony, in terms of as we were writing this book, we had multiple emotions as well. And it's not linear. It's an arc of 360-degree view of his life, but it's an arc of a very complicated man's life. And you know, we struggled with certain parts of the book where you feel really sad, you feel angry, you feel betrayed in a lot of ways by his actions against or with certain people. But the word that the caller used with he's human, for the longest time, I think as you'll see in this book, Tiger didn't act like a human being. He wasn't programmed to be a human being in the terms that we understand with thank yous and appreciation and gratitude. And it's only recently, which I think the book ends on a very positive note, as you mentioned in the opening, on his comeback, he's more human now than he's ever been. And I think that's for us as we're trying to put his life in perspective. It was almost pennies from heaven for us as we saw him change. And I saw him personally in several tournaments, and I saw him act differently than I had seen him act over the last 3 years.
Hmm. This might be a good time to hear a little bit of what you guys have written. Jeff, I know we've queued up a couple of readings for you to do. And just this issue about sort of the difficult side of Tiger Woods' character along the way, there's a reading that begins on page 176. So can you set that up for us? This is in 1998 when he's basically at Augusta with professional golfer Mark O'Meara, right? Can you sort of set up that reading?
Sure. The scene here is the year before, Tiger has won his first Masters as essentially a rookie. And it was the record-setting Masters that really blasted him into Tiger mania. 1 year later, he comes back to the Masters, and his neighbor and playing partner in Isleworth is Mark O'Meara. And Mark O'Meara wins the Masters in 98. So this scene happens right after Mark has won, which was an incredible experience for Mark. And they're now back at the house, which Tiger and Mark are renting together. So basically, the O'Meara family has been staying in this same house for years. And this year, Tiger is staying in that same house. And this is the passage. Back at the rental house, an atmosphere of euphoria set in. Never expecting her husband to win, Alicia hadn't packed any formal wear. Peggy Lewis gathered up shoes and a dress and raced back to her home to help Alicia get ready for the champion's dinner. While Mark and Tiger got ready, Alicia and Peggy went next door to iron the dress and have a glass of wine with the neighbors. After a few minutes, Tiger entered the house, next door to Lewis's in search of Alicia. Oh my God, Lewis thought. She knew Tiger was staying in her home, but she had yet to meet him. Excited, she stood and extended her hand. Hi, Tiger. My name is Peggy Lewis. You're staying in my house next door. Without saying a word, Tiger ignored Lewis's hand, turned to Alicia, and asked when they were leaving. Everyone stopped talking and looked at Lewis as she sheepishly withdrew her hand. Alicia looked at Tiger. I'll be over in a few minutes, she said. Humiliated, Lewis quietly sat down as Woods walked out, never acknowledging her.
So, Jeff, why did you—I mean, sort of tell me about the significance of that passage.
Well, Peggy Lewis is someone that had never been interviewed in her life. She's the kind of person that a sports reporter or a golf writer would probably never talk to. We thought she's exactly the kind of person we want to talk to because she owned the house that Tiger Woods stayed in every time he went to Augusta. And she had stories to tell that no one had heard because Tiger had slept in her home. And it wasn't just this. There was story after story from Augusta. And obviously the Masters is a big part of golf. And the fact that these scenes that took place in her rental home are at Augusta were important to us. But it showed Peggy Lewis is like many other people that we interviewed. She's a portal into this superstar that you've never got to look through before. And we went to her home. And we spent time with her down in Georgia. We looked through her scrapbooks. She has scrapbooks of Tiger Woods. Hmm. This is one of those people who would have been his biggest fan in the world if he had just said hi and shook her hand.
Yeah, right. And Armin, a moment ago, you were just talking about he sort of wasn't programmed to do that. I mean, can you say more about that? Is that just because of this sort of hyper-private upbringing that he had with his parents?
No, I think it's more about how Earl and Tita viewed the world. Mm-hmm. You have to understand Tiger Woods. And I think the driving questions that Jeff and I spent 3 years dealing with during the course of the reporting and the writing of this book were really two things. Who is Tiger Woods and what is the price of fame and genius? And I mean extreme fame and extreme genius. And in order to answer those questions, and I think we answer them, frankly, better than anyone has ever done, is you have to understand, you have to go back, you have to understand Earl Woods and what drove Earl Woods and the racial situations that he faced in his life and the discrimination that he faced in his life. And in many ways, Tiger was a form of revenge by Earl in what happened in Earl's life. And Tita was, in many ways, the original Tiger mom. She was the one that taught him that you don't just beat your opponents. You put your foot on their neck and you crush your opponents. Hmm. You make them remember that they lost to you so they never have the feeling that they can beat you when it counts. Those were, in the very simple ways, were the mantras that came out of the Woods family. And I think the beauty of this book is we don't just say it. The reporting, just for a moment, I mean, we spent 3 years, as I said, we read everything. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. We read 20 different books. We constructed a 120-page timeline that ran nearly 70,000 words. We listened or we had annotated and transcribed more than 300 press conferences that Tiger spoke at. So before we really started to write, we understood Tiger and we understood his perspective and we understood the arc of his life and how certain things slot into certain parts of his life. And that's where the power of the storytelling comes from, because it's not pell-mell. You're not just moving a puzzle piece. You're moving thousands of puzzle pieces together into a mosaic of somebody's life.
And you guys had to you guys had to deal with a big challenge, that you couldn't interview Tiger Woods because he didn't agree to an interview. You couldn't interview his mother either. Right? So this was a bit of how big a disappointment was that? How big a challenge did that pose for you?
That's not as big of a challenge as you might think. If you think about it, Anthony, many of the best biographies we've read are written about people who are deceased. The biographer never got to talk to that person. And in this case, did we want to talk to Tiger? Of course. Did we attempt that? Yes. And had he granted us an interview or interviews, which is what we were hoping for, that would have been terrific. But it wasn't an insurmountable challenge, the fact that he didn't talk to us. The fact was is that talking to over 250 people who have been very proximate and sometimes in his inner circle, but in some cases people who were very intimate with him, like his first girlfriend in high school. These are the people who could really allow us to see things about him that we could never see anywhere else. Those weren't in the books that we read. Those were not in the thousands of articles that Armin made reference to. These people who are still walking around who have these moments, and the funny thing is, it's not really funny, but it's interesting. When you have a moment with someone like Tiger Woods, those are the moments you never, ever forget. there's a level of credibility and believability in someone who recounts something that happened 20 years ago. A lot of times you're skeptical when someone says, well, I remember exactly what happened on that day 20 years ago. But if that day 20 years ago was when you met Tiger Woods, you remember that.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We're talking with Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan about a new biography, Tiger Woods. What do you remember? What do you love about Tiger Woods? Do you love Tiger Woods as a golfing great? Or do you have another view of him? Let's go to the phones. Gentlemen, we've got a lot of callers who want to get in on this conversation. So let's go to Don, who's calling from Baltimore. Don, good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Anthony. Very provocative discussion. I'm not a Tiger Woods fan, and there are three things that I would mention. First was learning, you know, about 10 or 12 years ago, just how cheap he is. This is a man of hundreds of millions of dollars, but yet he doesn't tip the valets when the cars get parked. He doesn't give interviews unless he gets paid for them. A second consideration is this is kept pretty quiet, is that poor behavior on the golf course has led to him being fined or held accountable in a number of ways. And the third concern is less about Tiger than the rest of the pro tour, who had to know about his extramarital relations and kept their mouths shut, did not say anything because he was their bank. As your guest said, he really raised the winning awards at these tournaments, and so he was making money for them, and they kept their mouths quiet about really was what pretty abysmal behavior.
All right, Don. Well, we appreciate you calling in, and we hear you loud and clear. We're going to talk about some of those points you raised, but let's go to Bonnie, who's calling from Norwood, Mass. Bonnie, you're on the air. Go ahead. It's good to have you.
Hello, Anthony. Thank you for taking my call. I would have to say that my attachment to Tiger is what I've learned over the years. I'm 76 years old, and it's the respect for excellence. If you look at any of the geniuses of the world, they had very skeptical lives. I feel that one of the things that influenced me in the beginning, because I had no interest in golf, was the fact that you never saw a black person really on the golf course. And lots of the response in the beginning was racist. People didn't want him to succeed. Now, did he take up a racist mantra? No, but it does not deny the excellence. And now what's even better is redemption. And the last caller talked about the financial raising of the finances for other golfers. These past 2 weeks, I don't care. There are lots of those golfers. I have yet to hear one that isn't just really wanting him to succeed because they know the respect for excellence in golf. So, you know, I learned a long time ago with politicians, they didn't have great private lives, and I had to decide whether I was going to vote for them or not on their excellent work.
Okay, Bonnie, we got it. So, yeah. Jeff Armin, two really interesting views there, and coming from two very different places. What do you think?
To go to the first caller, I would agree on the first two points. Tiger was cheap, and you know, he had some issues in other areas there. But as far as the tour pros knowing what was going on, absolutely not. Tiger kept his private life, his secret life, as secret as possible. Stevie Williams, his caddy, you know, Butch Harmon, Hank Haney, his swing coaches, had no idea. Tiger was extremely good at compartmentalizing his private and secret life. And to go to Bonnie just quickly before Jeff jumps in is she's right on. I mean, he was chasing perfection. And not just to be the greatest of his generation, but be the greatest of all time. And to Tiger's credit, he put in more time practicing and shaping shots and practicing in his hotel room than almost any professional golfer in history. I don't know one that would even compare. Maybe Nicklaus. Mm. But
Armin,
so
and,
that's there.
Yeah, Armin Katayan and Jeff Benedict, stand by. We're coming up on a break. We're talking about Tiger Woods, a new biography. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back after a short break. This is On Point.
When Cece Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about Tiger Woods, back pain, and the golfer's career now. You can join the conversation. What do you make of this super athlete with superhuman flaws? Are you rooting for his comeback? My guests, Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan, authors of Tiger Woods, which is out today. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Last week, Tiger Woods spoke to ESPN about his back pain. He had four spine surgeries in less than 3 years, but is now back on the course. But he talked about what the pain felt like during his worst moments.
For the better part of 4 to 6 months, I had to be helped out of bed every day. And there are some days where I just, even you helped me, I couldn't stand up. I'd have to just, you know, either fall to the floor or just stay in bed. I felt like I just couldn't participate in my own life.
Well, Jeff and Armin, he's doing more than participating in his old in his own life now. He's playing golf again, and people are saying he's playing pretty well. What are you seeing out there of Tiger Woods today?
Well, I think that's a pretty big admission coming from him to talk about not being able to get out of bed and mm-hmm. not be able to have his old life, because his old life isn't like anyone else's life. He was, for a long period of time, the best in the world at one thing, and then suddenly that thing was taken away from him. He couldn't do the thing that he's been born to do and that he does better than anyone else. When you couple that with immobility, anybody who's had severe pain or physical immobility, they know what it's like to have your life turned upside down, and then multiply it by his situation. I think it says a lot about what he's been through in the last few years as he's been away from the game. And now that he's back, that smile that Armin referred to earlier that he noticed when Armin was with him a few weeks ago, you're seeing a guy who's genuinely happy, and he's walking around physically looking different than he's ever looked before. Fans notice it. People on the tour notice it. This is it's a different outlook and perspective from him.
And Armin, how's his golf?
Well, I saw him at Torrey Pines, and the book sort of ends there as he's playing the South Course and he makes the cut at Torrey Pines at the Farmers Insurance Open. And, you know, I'm kind of a little bit of a tigerologist in terms of spending the last 3 years with him and watching his swing. He's very close. And, you know, he's getting very close to dialing in to the kind of shots that Tiger Woods has made legend on the tour. And I find it funny, Anthony, that in a unique way that these young guns, the John Rahms and the Justin Thomas and the Jordan Spieths and all these young players who say, Patrick Reed, who say, I can't wait to play and compete against Tiger on a Sunday in a major as we move towards the Masters. And so many of the older pros have said, you have no idea what you're in for.
Huh.
It may seem like something that you want to do, but it's like the old Mike Tyson line, you know, everybody's got a plan until they get hit in the face. And the crowds at Torrey were unbelievable, and they've just built as he's gone to Riviera and then the Honda and then the Valspar. And I think Augusta is going to be an incredible experience, that if he's in the hunt on Sunday at Augusta on the back nine, you're going to see, I think, record-setting TV viewerships, because as you mentioned, there's redemption here. There is a comeback story that very few people, and it's easy to forget that less than a year ago, on Memorial Day weekend in 2017, he was found on the side of the road, basically comatose, with a cocktail of drugs in his system as he was trying to deal with all this pain. And he went through an opiate addiction. He came out of that into the light now. And it's a remarkable comeback story that very few people, I think, would have had the will and the intestinal fortitude to come from.
Mm. I want to talk to you both about when he was in his prime, how Tiger Woods talked about his race. And so I want to listen back to an interview he did with Oprah Winfrey in 1997. So 21-year-old Tiger Woods was asked about how he identifies in regard to race and ethnicity. This was after his dad, Earl Woods, famously declared that, quote, it was about time that a black guy, unquote, won the Masters tournament. So here's Tiger's response.
Well, funny thing is, growing up, I came up with his name. I'm a Coblin Asian.
A Coblin Asian. Caucasian, blue, black, Indian, Asian, Coblin Asian.
That's what you call yourself?
Yeah.
Coblin Asian. So, Jeff, Armin, what did you discover in writing this story about this sort of complicated relationship he had with his own ethnicity?
Well, like so many other aspects of Tiger's life, the whole issue of his views on race and how he wanted to talk about race were put on him early. His father was very outspoken about race, and he talked about it a lot, and people knew exactly where Earl stood, and with some good reason, because Earl was a victim of racism at different parts of his life. And so he had a reason to feel the way he feels. But Tiger, you know, Tiger was different than his dad in a lot of ways. And at a very early age, people expected him to have adult-like views and make adult-like statements about race. And I think he had a spotlight on him that if you think back to how articulate were you at 19 mm-hmm. on the subject of race in America, that's a big topic. And Tiger was coming on the scene at a time when race in America was very much on our minds. And so he distanced himself from it. And I think part of that is probably due to, you know, needing the time to figure out what were his views on race and what did he really think about it. Because if you look at his statements from high school through college to his early days as pros, they are evolving. He's not saying exactly the same thing. Whereas his dad had a heavy hand when it came to race, and he would pound the gavel, so to speak. I think Tiger's views have, like a lot of us, they've changed over time, and his views on race today they're more sophisticated than they were when we're writing about him as he's turning pro and everybody wants to ask him about race. You can hear it in his voice on Oprah Winfrey. In many ways, he is still a kid who's just came on the scene, and he's being hit with very adult-like questions.
And it's interesting because Tiger, you know, one of the things that Earl said at one point in time was, and I may mangle the quote slightly, but, you know, he's only got about two drops of black blood in him. But in America, you're either white or you're non-white. And those were very powerful statements that Earl hung on his son's shoulders that he had to deal with as he's basically moving through Shoal Creek and he's dealing with the, you know, the master's situation and what the membership was like there. It was a constant drumbeat in his life. And where Tiger found peace was in one place, inside the ropes, doing what he was born and trained and I dare say programmed to do. The mm-hmm. other things on the outside were really outside influences that he really struggled with over time.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Lewis is calling from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Lewis, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Anthony. I wanted to kind of reiterate the race issue.
Yeah, go ahead, Lewis.
My problem was that he wouldn't really embrace the black community and wouldn't talk about his blackness. But Fuzzy Zeller told him at the Masters, you know, that he didn't want any chicken and watermelon at the Masters dinner. So he's a black man kind of denying his blackness. Now, him being an adulterer, that was between him and his wife. That didn't bother me. But him not embracing the black community, that really bothered me. And kind of marrying the most fairest blonde-haired woman that he could find, that kind of bothered me. So that's why I'm not really a Tiger Woods fan.
We got it, Lewis, and I appreciate the call. Go ahead. I hear someone go ahead, Jeff.
Anthony, one thing that struck me about all your callers, actually, as I listen to these questions, is the incredible diversity of these people who are calling in and the statements they're making. It speaks to the point of how transcendent Tiger Woods is. People care about this guy, and what I mean is it matters to people what this guy does and what he represents. And to this last caller's comments, what I found fascinating was that although Tiger Woods was raised by a dad who was very race conscious, he was insulated from the black community with the way he was raised. And it's an ironic situation because mm-hmm. Tiger grows up in manicured lawns at country clubs that are populated by rich white people. That's the life he knows. I mean, he is at the Beverly Hills Country Club as a teenager, literally days after Rodney King was beaten on the side of a road really close to where he lives and really close to that country club. And he goes there that day, and he is the only teenager of color who's at a golf clinic with Jack Nicklaus. And you have all these wealthy white people who are watching this boy who Jack Nicklaus singles out and compliments, probably to the envy of all the other white parents who were there. But that's – Tiger was put in that really unusual environment as a child of color. And so he didn't get exposure to race except through his dad. He wasn't really plugged into the black community because he's on golf courses all the time. And I think it's just another thing that's interesting about his life and his upbringing that played out in some unusual ways once he was under the spotlight and being asked about race.
Yeah, interesting. Sounds like he was put in a position for which he just wasn't qualified in a way. I mean, as you say, brought up on golf courses that were populated mostly by white folks. And a lot of pressure to sort of speak up as a black athlete, you can understand.
Well, he never had a job, Anthony. He never had to do anything. He never grew up in a world that I would venture to say every single one of your listeners grew up in, where you had responsibilities. And his responsibility was to win golf tournaments, and he was going to be what his parents proclaimed him to be.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to just we still got so many callers and our time grows short. Let's go with the callers. Vanessa is calling from Norwich, Connecticut. Vanessa, you're on the air. Go ahead. Good to have you.
Yes. Hello, Anthony. Thank you. I have a few brief statements. One, I think there's too much focus on what Tiger Woods either has or has not done for the black community. It's kind of pointless in a sense that he is multiracial. The other issue with that is you don't hear that in reference to a Caucasian person. We don't focus on what a Caucasian person does for the Caucasian community. So I think there needs to be a separation. At the end of the day, people are people. People are imperfect, and they make bad choices. As far as the extramarital affairs, yes, that was awful. I don't know how many people did know or didn't know. That was an ugly situation that went down between him and his wife, and she did the right thing. She did what she needed to do, which was getting out. I think we should separate that Me Too issue from that, because these were willing participants in this extramarital behavior. You didn't hear of anyone coming forth saying Tiger made them do anything. So I don't think that should be part of the Me Too movement. We need to make a distinction with that, because those are real issues of women who were forced into situations that they did not want and need to be in.
Vanessa, thanks so much for the call. We're going to put that on the table and come back to it. I want to get another caller in, though. Anthony is calling from East Haddam, Connecticut. Anthony, you're on the air. It's good to have you. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Anthony, I guess. Can't wait to read that book. I'm a pretty avid golfer. I have like a 20 handicap, and I've been following him since day one. And I didn't like his attitude during that, when he was at his peak. He always had like this chip on his shoulder, and I didn't like him, you know. And then when this incident happened with his wife, I was like, well, that's really no surprise to me. You could just kind of see it was coming. And then he goes through the Valley of Darkness, and now he's coming back, and you can see he's got a completely different attitude. And I like him now. It's like he's smiling more. And
you're like us. Like, yeah, we like him too.
Yeah, so Jeff and Armin, he came through the Valley of Darkness. And
That's a nice line. I wish we would have had that one.
You guys
should
have had that one. But it sounds like you all agree that he was sort of humanized by this fall from grace, I guess.
That's the best word. I mean, it's the word that comes up. Mark O'Meara has one of the great quotes in this book. He said, sooner or later, you have to be a human. You have to be a human being. And for the longest time, Tiger's transcendence and his greatness that we all watched and were thrilled by came with a tremendous cost, a personal price, which was a real loss of an absence of humanity. I think what he's gone through of late has changed him in so many ways, and he's become a human being.
I want to try to get one more call in before our time runs out. Lewis is calling from Manchester, Tennessee. Lewis, go ahead. It's good to have you.
Hi, thank you. No doubt that Tiger is a great golfer of our generation, but in terms of the most influential athlete of our time, I think that still has to be Muhammad Ali. He was stripped of his right to be an athlete by a total lack of due process, and at his peak, I remember reading that he was the most recognizable person on the planet. More people knew who Ali was than the president of the United States or the Pope.
Lewis, I'm really glad you called in with this, and I'm just going to jump in because we're literally running out of time. But Jeff and Armin, I love it that Lewis put on the table sort of the comparison with Muhammad Ali, because you can debate it, but just the fact that you're having the discussion of Tiger Woods in the same breath as Muhammad Ali tells you something about how Tiger Woods is viewed.
In fact, I think he makes a great point, and it's actually something we acknowledge in the book, is that Muhammad Ali is probably the one person that belongs in that conversation with Tiger. They're in the conversation together for different reasons. I mean, for a stand he took, Tiger's there purely for not only just his greatness, but he endeared a level of fame that was even unknown to Ali, because he came into it with the age of social media and TMZ and the wall-to-wall media coverage that Muhammad Ali didn't have. I mean, there was a scrutiny of Tiger Woods' life that even Ali didn't endure. Now, obviously, when he decided to not be in the draft, that was a big deal. But Tiger's personal affairs were played out day after day after day in homes and on televisions all over this country. People watched him come apart, and it put him under a spotlight that I think Armin and I just looked at that and go, it's hard to find an athlete, partly because of the digital age, who compares with Tiger Woods.
All right. Well, the book is Tiger Woods. The authors, Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan, thank you both so much for joining us today. Congratulations on this book. It's a ripping read, I got to say, about a larger-than-life guy. Thank you for the book. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.